The temporal ruler of the sprawling city of Ankh-Morpork was sitting in his chair at the foot of the steps leading up to the throne, looking for any signs of intelligence in intelligence reports. The throne had been empty for more than 2,000 years since the death of the last of the line of the kings of Ankh. Legend said that one day the city would have a king again, and went on with various comments about magic swords, strawberry birthmarks, and all the other things that legends gabble on about in these circumstances. In fact, the only real qualification now was the ability to stay alive for more than about 5 minutes after revealing the existence of any magic swords or birthmarks, because the great merchant families of Ankh had been ruling the city for the last 20 centuries and were about as ready to relinquish power as the average limpet is to let go of its rock. The current patrician, head of the extremely rich and powerful Vetinari family, was thin, tall, and apparently as cold-blooded as a dead penguin. Just by looking at him, you could tell he was the sort of man you'd expect to keep a white cat and caress it idly while sentencing people to death in a piranha tank, and you'd hazard for a good measure that he probably collected rare thin porcelain, turning it over and over in his blue-white fingers while distant screams echoed from the depths of the dungeons. You wouldn't put it past him to use the word exquisite, and have thin lips. He looked the kind of person who, when they blink, you mark it off on the calendar. Practically none of this was the case, although he did have a small and exceedingly elderly wire-haired terrier called Waffles that smelled badly and wheezed at people. It was said to be the only thing in the entire world he truly cared about. He did, of course, sometimes have people horribly tortured to death, but this was considered to be perfectly acceptable behaviour for a civic ruler, and generally approved of by the overwhelming majority of citizens. The overwhelming majority of citizens being defined in this case as everyone not currently hanging upside down over a scorpion pit. The people of Ankh are of a practical persuasion, and felt that the patrician's edict forbidding all street theatre and mime artists made up for a lot of things. He didn't administer a reign of terror, just the occasional light shower. The patrician sighed, and laid the latest report on top of the large heap beside the chair. When he'd been a little boy, he'd seen a showman who could keep a dozen plates spinning in the air. If the man had been capable of working the same trick with 100 of them, Lord Vetinari considered, he would just about begin to be ready for training in the art of ruling Ankh-Morpork, a city once described as resembling an overturned termite heap, without the charm. He glanced out of the window at the distant pillar of the Tower of Art, the centre of the unseen university, and wondered vaguely whether any of those tiresome old fools could come up with a better way of collating all this paperwork. They wouldn't, of course. You couldn't expect a wizard to understand anything as basic as elementary civic espionage. He sighed again, and picked up the transcript of what the president of the Thieves' Guild had said to his deputy at midnight in the soundproof room hidden behind the office in the guild headquarters, and was in the Great Hall. Was not in the Great Hall of Unseen University, where he had spent some interminable dinners, but there were a lot of wizards around him, and they were different. Like Death, which some of the city's less fortunate citizens considered he intimately resembled, the patrician never got angry until he had had time to think about it. But sometimes he thought very quickly. He stared around at the assembled wizards, but there was something about them that choked the words of outrage in his throat. They looked like sheep who had suddenly found a trapped wolf at exactly the same time as they'd heard about the idea of unity being strength. There was something about their eyes. "What is the meaning of this out?" he hesitated and concluded. "This. A merry small God's day prank, is it?" His eyes swiveled to meet those of a small boy holding a long metal staff. The child was smiling the oldest smile the patrician had ever seen. Carding coughed. "My lord," he began. "Out with it, man," snapped Lord Vetinari. Carding had been diffident, but the patrician's tone was just that tiny bit too peremptory. The wizard's knuckles went white. "I am a wizard of the 8th level," he said quietly, "and you will not use that tone to me."
"Well said," said Coyne.
"Take him to the dungeons," said Carding.
"We haven't got any dungeons," said Spelter. "This is a university."
"Then take him to the wine cellars," snapped Carding, "and while you're down there, build some dungeons."
"Have you the faintest inkling of what you're doing?" said the patrician. "I demand to know the meaning of this."
"You demand nothing at all," said Carding, "and the meaning is that from now on the wizards will rule, as it was ordained. Now, take...
You, rule Ankh-Morpork. Wizards who can barely govern themselves?
Yes.
Carding was aware that this wasn't the last word in repartee, and was even more aware to the fact that the dog Waffles, who had been teleported along with his master, had waddled painfully across the floor and was peering short-sightedly at the wizard's boots.
Then all truly wise men would prefer the safety of a nice, deep dungeon, said the patrician. And now will you cease this foolery and replace me in my palace? And it is just possible that we will say no more about this, or at least you won't have the chance to.
Waffles gave up investigating Carding's boots and trotted towards Coin, shedding a few hairs on the way.
This pantomime has gone on long enough, said the patrician. Now I am getting...
Waffles growled. It was a deep primeval noise which struck a chord in the racial memory of all those present and filled them with an urgent desire to climb a tree. It suggested long grey shapes hunting in the dawn of time. It was astonishing that such a small animal could contain so much menace, and all of it was aimed at the staff in Coin's hand. The patrician strode forward to snatch the animal, and Carding raised his hand and sent a blaze of orange and blue fire searing across the room. The patrician vanished. On the spot where he had been standing, a small yellow lizard blinked and glared with malevolent reptilian stupidity. Carding looked in astonishment at his fingers, as if for the first time.
"All right," he whispered hoarsely.
The wizard stared down at the panting lizard, and then out at the city sparkling in the early morning light. Out there was the Council of Aldermen, the City Watch, the Guild of Thieves, the Guild of Merchants, the priesthoods, and none of them knew what was about to hit them.
"It has begun," said the Hat from its box on the deck.
"What has?" said Rincewind.
"The rule of sorcery."
Rincewind looked blank. "Is that good?"
"Do you ever understand anything anyone says to you?"
Rincewind felt on firmer ground here.
"No," he said. "Not always, not lately, not often."
"Are you sure you are a wizard?" said Cunina.
"It's the only thing I've ever been sure of," he said, with conviction.
"How strange." Rincewind sat on the luggage in the sun on the foredeck of the Ocean Waltzer, as it lurched peacefully across the green waters of the Circle Sea. Around them men did what he was sure were important nautical things, and he hoped they were doing them correctly, because next to heights he hated depths most of all.
"You look worried," said Canina, who was cutting his hair.
Rincewind tried to make his head as small as possible as the blades flashed by.
"That's because I am."
"What exactly is the apocalypse?"
Rincewind hesitated.
"Well," he said, "it's the end of the world, sort of."
"Sort of? Sort of the end of the world? You mean we won't be certain? We'll all look around and say, 'Pardon me, did you hear something?'"
"It's just that no two seers have ever agreed about it. There have been all kinds of vague predictions, quite mad, some of them. So it was called the apocalypse."
He looked embarrassed.
"It's a sort of apocryphal apocalypse. A kind of pun, you see."
"Not very good."
"No, I suppose not."
Wizards' tastes in the matter of puns are about the same as their taste in glittery objects. Canina's scissors snipped busily.
"I must say the captain seemed quite happy to have us aboard," she observed.
"That's because they think it's lucky to have a wizard on the boat," said Rincewind. "It isn't, of course."
"Lots of people believe it," she said.
"Oh, it's lucky for other people, just not for me. I can't swim."
"What, not a stroke?"
Rincewind hesitated and twiddled the star in his hat cautiously.
"About how deep is the sea here, would you say, approximately?" he said.
"About a dozen fathoms, I believe.
Then I could probably swim about a dozen fathoms, whatever they are."
"Stop trembling like that. I nearly had your ear off,"
Canina snapped. She glared at a passing seaman and waved her scissors.
"What's the matter? You never saw a man have a haircut before?"
Someone up in the rigging made a remark which caused a ripple of ribald laughter in the topgallants, unless they were forecastles.
"I shall pretend I didn't hear that," said Canina, and gave the comb a savage yank, dislodging numerous inoffensive small creatures.
"Ow!"
"Well, you should keep still."
"It's a little difficult to keep still, knowing who it is that's waving a couple of steel blades around my head."
And so the morning passed, with scudding wavelets, the creaking of the rigging, and a rather complex layer cut. Rincewind had to admit, looking at himself in the shard of a mirror, that there was a definite improvement. The captain had said that they were bound for the city of Al-Khali on the hubward coast of Klatch.
"Like Ankh, only with sand instead of mud," said Rincewind, leaning over the rail. "But quite a good slave market."
"Slavery is immoral," said Kanina firmly.
"Is it?
Gosh," said Rincewind. "Would you like me to trim your beard?" said Kanina hopefully. She stopped, scissors drawn, and stared out to sea.
"Is there a kind of sailor that uses a canoe with sort of extra bits on the side, and sort of red eye painted on the front, and a small sail?" she said.
"I've heard of Clatchian slave pirates," said Rincewind, "but this is a big boat. I shouldn't think one of them would dare attack it."
"One of them wouldn't," said Kanina, still staring at the fuzzy area where the sea became the sky.
"But these five might."
Rincewind peered at the distant haze and then looked up at the man on watch, who shook his head.
"Come, Un," he chuckled with all the humour of a blocked drain. "You can't really see anything out there, can you?"
10 men in each canoe," said Kanina grimly.
"Look, a joke's a joke. With long, curvy swords. Well, I can't see it. They're long and rather dirty hair blowing in the wind."
"With split ends, I expect," said Rincewind sourly.
"Are you trying to be funny?"
"Me?"
"And here's me without a weapon," said Kanina, sweeping back across the deck. "I bet there isn't a decent sword anywhere on this boat.
Never mind, perhaps they've just come for a quick shampoo."
While Kanina rummaged frantically in her pack, Rincewind sidled over to the Arch-Chancellor's hatbox and cautiously raised the lid.
"There's nothing out there, is there?"
he asked.
"How should I know? Put me on."
"What? On my head?"
"Good grief."
"But I'm not an Arch-Chancellor," said Rincewind. "I mean, I've heard of cool-headed, but
I need to use your eyes. Now put me on your head."
"Hmm?
Trust me."
Rincewind couldn't disobey. He gingerly removed his battered grey hat, looked longingly at its dishevelled star, and lifted the Arch-Chancellor's hat out of its box. It felt rather heavier than he'd expected. The octarines around the crown were glowing faintly. He lowered it carefully onto his new hairstyle, clutching the brim tightly in case he felt the first icy chill. In fact, he simply felt incredibly light, and there was a feeling of great knowledge and power, not actually present, but just, mentally speaking, on the tip of his metaphorical tongue. Odd scraps of memory flickered across his mind, and they weren't any memories he remembered remembering before. He probed gently as one touches a hollow tooth with the tongue. And there they were. 200 dead Arch-Chancellors dwindling into the leaden, freezing past. One behind the other, watching him with blank grey eyes. "That's why it's so cold," he told himself. "The warmth seeps into the dead world."
Oh, no.
When the hat spoke, he saw 200 pairs of pale lips move.
"Who are you?"
Rincewind, thought Rincewind, and in the inner recesses of his head he tried to think privately to himself. Help. He felt his knees begin to buckle under the weight of centuries.
"What's it like being dead?" he thought.
"Death is but a sleep," said the dead mages.
"But what does it feel like?" Rincewind thought. "You will have an unrivalled chance to find out when those war canoes get here, Rincewind."
With a yelp of terror, he thrust upwards and forced the hat off his head. Real life and the sound flooded back in, but since someone was frantically banging a gong very close to his ear, this was not much of an improvement. The canoes were visible to everyone now, cutting through the water with an eerie silence. Those black-clad figures manning the paddles should have been whooping and screaming. It wouldn't have made it any better, but it would have seemed more appropriate. The silence bespoke an unpleasant air of purpose.
"God, that was awful," he said. "Mind you, so is this."
Crew members scurried across the deck, cutlasses in hand. Kanina tapped Rincewind on the shoulder.
"They'll try to take us alive," she said.
"Oh," said Rincewind weakly. "Good." Then he remembered something else about Clatchian slavers, and his throat went dry.
You'll be the one they'll really be after," he said. "I've heard about what they do."
"Should I know?" said Kanina.
To Rincewind's horror, she didn't appear to have found a weapon.
"They'll throw you in a seraglio,"
she shrugged.
"Oh, could be worse."
"But it's got all these spikes, and when they shut the door," hazarded Rincewind. The canoes were close enough now to see the determined expressions of the rowers.
"That's not a seraglio, that's an Iron Maiden. Don't you know what a seraglio is?"
She told him. He went crimson. "Anyway, they'll have to capture me first," said Kanina primly. "It's you who should be worrying."
"Why me?"
"You're the only other one who's wearing a dress."
Rincewind bridled. "It's a robe."
"Robe, dress?
You better hope they know the difference. A hand like a bunch of bananas with rings on grabbed Rincewind's shoulder and spun him around. The captain, a hublander built on generous bear-like lines, beamed at him through a mass of facial hair.
Ah, he said. They know not that we aboard a wizard have to create in their bellies the burning green fire. Ha!
The dark forests of his eyebrows wrinkled as it became apparent that Rincewind wasn't immediately ready to hurl vengeful magic at the invaders.
Ha!
He insisted, making a mere single syllable do the work of a whole string of blood-congealing threats.
Yes, well, I'm just girding my loins, said Rincewind. That's what I'm doing, girding them. Green fire, you want?
Also to make hot lead run in their bones, said the captain. Also, their skins to blister and living scorpions without mercy to eat their brains from inside. And
the leading canoe came alongside, and a couple of grapnels thudded into the rail. As the first of the slavers appeared, the captain hurried away, drawing his sword. He stopped for a moment and turned to Rincewind.
You gird quickly, he said, or no loins, huh?
Rincewind turned to Canina, who was leaning on the rail, examining her fingernails. You'd better get on with it, she said. That's 50 green fires and hot leads to go, with a side order for blisters and scorpions. Hold the mercy.
This sort of thing is always happening to me, he moaned.
He peered over the rail to what he thought of as the main floor of the boat. The invaders were winning by sheer weight of numbers, using nets and ropes to tangle the struggling crew. They worked in absolute silence, clubbing and dodging, avoiding the use of swords wherever possible. Mustn't damage the merchandise, said Canina. Rincewind watched in horror as the captain went down under a press of dark shapes, screaming,
Green fire! Green fire!
Rincewind backed away. He wasn't any good at magic, but he'd had 100% success at staying alive up to now, and he didn't want to spoil the record. All he needed to do was to learn how to swim in the time it took to dive into the sea. It was worth a try.
What are you waiting for? Let's go while they're occupied, he said to Canina.
I need a sword, she said. You'll be spoilt for choice in a minute. One will be enough. Rincewind kicked the luggage. Come on, he snarled. You've got a lot of floating to do. The luggage extended its little legs with exaggerated nonchalance, turned slowly, and settled down beside the girl.
Traitor, said Rincewind to its hinges.
The battle already seemed to be over. Five of the raiders stalked up the ladder to the afterdeck, leaving most of their colleagues to round up the defeated crew below. The leader pulled down his mask and leered briefly and swarthily at Canina, and then he turned and leered for a slightly longer period at Rincewind.
This is a robe, said Rincewind quickly, and you'd better watch out because I'm a wizard.
He took a deep breath.
Lay a finger on me and you'll make me wish you hadn't. I warn you.
A wizard? Wizards don't make good strong slaves, mused the leader.
Absolutely right, said Rincewind. So if you'll just see your way clear to letting me go.
The leader turned back to Canina and signalled to one of his companions. He jerked a tattooed thumb towards Rincewind.
Do not kill him too quickly. In fact,
he paused and treated Rincewind to a smile full of teeth.
Maybe, yes. And why not? Can you sing, wizard?
I might be able to, said Rincewind cautiously. Why?
You could be just the man the serif needs for a job in the harem.
A couple of slavers sniggered.
It could be a unique opportunity,
the leader went on, encouraged by this audience appreciation. There was more broad-minded approval from behind him. Rincewind backed away.
I don't think so, he said. Thanks all the same. I'm not cut out for that kind of thing.
Oh, but you could be, said the leader, his eyes bright. You could be.
Oh, for goodness sake, muttered Canina. She glanced at the men on either side of her, and then her hands moved. The one stabbed with the scissors was possibly better off than the one she raked with the comb, given the kind of mess a steel comb can make of a face. Then she reached down, snatched up a sword dropped by one of the stricken men, and lunged at the other two. The leader turned at the screams and saw the luggage behind him with its lid open. And then Rincewind cannoned into the back of him, pitching him forward into whatever oblivion lay in the multidimensional depths of the chest. There was the start of a bellow, abruptly cut off. Then there was a click like the shooting of the bolt on the gates of hell. Rincewind backed away, trembling.
A unique opportunity, he muttered under his breath, having just got the reference.
At least he had a unique opportunity to watch Canina fight. Not many men ever got to see it twice. Her opponents started off grinning at the temerity of a slight young girl in attacking them, and then rapidly passed through various stages of puzzlement, doubt, concern, and abject gibbering terror, as they apparently became the centre of a flashing, tightening circle of steel. She disposed of the last of the leader's bodyguards with a couple of thrusts that made Rincewind's eyes water, and with a sigh vaulted the rail onto the main deck. To Rincewind's annoyance, the luggage barreled after her, cushioning its fall by dropping heavily onto a slaver, and adding to the sudden panic of the invaders, because while it was bad enough to be attacked with deadly and ferocious accuracy by a rather pretty girl in a white dress with flowers on it, it was even worse for the male ego to be tripped up and bitten by a travel accessory. It was pretty bad for all the rest of the male, too. Rincewind peered over the railing. "Show off," he muttered. A throwing knife clipped the wood near his chin and ricocheted past his ear. He raised his hand to the sudden stinging pain and stared at it in horror before gently passing out. It wasn't blood in general he couldn't stand the sight of. It was just his blood in particular that was so upsetting. The market in Sator Square, the wide expanse of cobbles outside the black gates of the university, was in full cry. It was said that everything in Ankh-Morpork was for sale, except for the beer and the women, both of which one merely hired. And most of the merchandise was available in Sator Market, which over the years had grown, stall by stall, until the newcomers were up against the ancient stones of the university itself. In fact, they made a handy display area for bolts of cloth and racks of charms. No one noticed the gates swing back, but a silence rolled out of the university, spreading out across the noisy, crowded square like the first fresh wavelets of the tide trickling over a brackish swamp. In fact, it wasn't true silence at all, but a great roar of anti-noise. Silence isn't the opposite of sound, it is merely its absence. But this was the sound that lies on the far side of silence, anti-noise, its shadowy decibels throttling the market cries like a fall of velvet. The crowds stared around wildly, mouthing like goldfish, and with about as much effect. All heads turned towards the gates. Something else was flowing out besides that cacophony of hush. The stalls nearest the empty gateway began to grind across the cobbles, shedding merchandise. Their owners dived out of the way as the stalls hit the row behind them and scraped relentlessly onwards, piling up until a wide avenue of clean, empty stones stretched the whole width of the square. Ardrothi Longstaff, purveyor of pies full of personality, peered over the top of the wreckage of his stall in time to see the wizards emerge. He knew wizards, or up until now he'd always thought he did. They were vague old boys, harmless enough in their way, dressed like ancient sofas, always ready customers for any of his merchandise that happened to be marked down on account of age, and rather more personality than a prudent housewife would be prepared to put up with. But these wizards were something new to Ardrothi. They walked into Sator Square as if they owned it. Little blue sparks flashed around their feet. They seemed a little taller somehow. Or perhaps it was just the way they carried themselves. Yes, that was it. Ardrothi had a touch of magic in his genetic makeup, and as he watched the wizards sweep across the square, it told him that the very best thing he could do for his health would be to pack his knives, spices, and mincers in his little pack, and have it away out of the city at any time in the next 10 minutes. The last wizard in the group lagged behind his colleagues and looked around the square with disdain. "There used to be fountains out here," he said. "You people, be off." The traders stared at one another. Wizards normally spoke imperiously, but that was to be expected. But there was an edge to the voice that no one had heard before. It had knuckles in it. Ardrothi's eyes swiveled sideways. Arising out of the ruins of his jellied starfish and clam stall like an avenging angel, dislodging various mollusks from his beard and spitting vinegar, was Miskin Coble, who was said to be able to open oysters with one hand. Years of pulling limpets off rocks and wrestling the giant cockles in Ankh Bay had given him the kind of physical development normally associated with tectonic plates. He didn't so much stand up as unfold. Then he thudded his way towards the wizard and pointed a trembling finger at the ruins of his stall, from which half a dozen enterprising lobsters were making a determined bid for freedom. Muscles moved around the edges of his mouth like angry eels.
"Did you do that?" he demanded. "Stand aside, oaf," said the wizard.
Three words which, in the opinion of Ardrothi, gave him the ongoing life expectancy of a glass symbol.
"I hates wizards," said Coble. "I really hates wizards. So I am going to hit you, all right?"
He brought his fist back and let fly. The wizard raised an eyebrow. Yellow fire sprang up around the shellfish salesman. There was a noise like tearing silk, and Coble had vanished. All that was left was his boots, standing forlornly on the cobbles with little wisps of smoke coming out of them. No one knows why smoking boots always remain, no matter how big the explosion. It seems to be just one of those things. It seemed to the watchful eyes of Ardrothi that the wizard himself was nearly as shocked as the crowd, but he rallied magnificently and gave his staff a flourish. "You people had better jolly well learn from this," he said. "No one raises their hand to a wizard, do you understand? There are going to be a lot of changes round here. Yes, what do you want?" His last comment was to Ardrothi, who was trying to sneak past unnoticed. He scrabbled quickly in his pie tray.
"I was just wondering if your honour ship would care to purchase one of the finest pies," he said hurriedly. "Full of nourish."
"Watch closely, pie-selling person," said the wizard. He stretched out his hand, made a strange gesture with his fingers, and produced a pie out of the air. It was fat, golden brown, and beautifully glazed. Just by looking at it, Ardrothi knew it was packed edge to edge with prime lean pork, with none of those spacious areas of good fresh air under the lid that represented his own profit margin. It was the kind of pie piglets hope to be when they grow up. His heart sank. His ruin was floating in front of him with short crust pastry on it.
"Want a taste?" said the wizard. "There's plenty more where that came from."
"Wherever it came from," said Ardrothi. He looked past the shiny pastry to the face of the wizard, and in the manic gleam of those eyes he saw the world turning upside down. He turned away a broken man and set out for the nearest city gate. As if it wasn't bad enough that wizards were killing people, he thought bitterly, they were taking away their livelihood as well.